Is there anything you would have done differently?
We reported a true story.
Our colleague Brian Williams is back in Kuwait City tonight after a close call on the skies over Iraq.
Controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and questions about Kavanaugh's drinking in the past.
Sean Hannity, come on up, Sean Hannity.
Today, Andrew Cuomo is having a moment.
I'm Chris Steigerwalt.
I am not Eliana Johnson.
Welcome to Ink Stained Wretches, where we break down what's going wrong and, yes, what is going right with the American news media. And who is not Eliana Johnson? Most people are not Eliana Johnson, but we are particularly lucky because we have with us the man who I credit or blame for doing this podcast, John Podoritz, the editor of
No idea that that was the case, so please enlighten me.
Editor of Commentary Magazine, is that the full title? Are you editor-in-chief?
That
are
is,
you
Regis? Editor.
Okay. Editor of the great, useful, important Commentary Magazine, opinion writer at the New York Post, veteran of decades of the media wars of America, one of my truly favorite people. And when I started doing this podcast with Eliana, which I originally looked at as just an opportunity to do something with a friend, and like, I don't know what I thought it was. John, you were one of the first people that when you told me you actually listened to it and you liked it, I thought, oh my gosh, I may actually do this. And so I did, thanks to you.
I'm honored. I'm honored to have contributed to the longevity of this extremely amusing and enlightening podcast, which I do listen to, I guess, every Friday, except when you sometimes release it on Saturday.
Well, and you, this is coming from a person who produces 6 hours of podcasts a week, five, six hours
of podcasts a week. It's about five of the commentary podcasts, and then twice monthly, our mutual friend Jonah Goldberg and I and our friend Rob Long do this Glop Culture podcast. So having once said I would never do any podcasting, Noah Rothman, who has now left Commentary and is at National Review, came to me on the staff of Commentary and said we should do a podcast. And I was like, I don't like podcasts. They're raw. I like things that are produced to a high level of sheen. I think that's what professionalism is. Commentary as a physical product, we're very careful with the way it looks, with the way it's presented, and that podcasting seemed to me to be like amateur hour. And he was like, all right, well, look, let's just try it. So I said, okay, we'll try it. We're not going to spend any money on it. Like, we're spending no money on it. We're just buying mics and we're doing it that way and we're not going to spend any money on it and I'm not going to prepare. I don't want to, I'm not doing any, and if it, we'll give it a shot. And then people seem to like it. So I've now become, you know, basically I'm like a ham radio operator in the late. So, you know, there's a great, actually Garrison Keillor wrote a novel, the name of which I right now eludes me, about early radio podcasting is a little like early radio in that people started radio channels to promote their drugstore in,
yes,
in like the early 20s. You would have like W. Phil's Drugstore and they would sit in the drugstore window and play music and talk as a commercial for the drugstore. And that was what the Commentary podcast was a commercial for Commentary, was a promotional tool for Commentary. And you know, then the question is always whether the tail starts to wag the dog when you do this and people listen and pay attention and all of that.
Most famously, WGN Radio stands for World's Greatest Newspaper.
Yes.
For the Chicago Tribune. Yep. And my other favorite anecdote about that is that when KDKA was the first radio station to broadcast presidential election results ever in 1924. They did it from the roof of the Westinghouse building in Pittsburgh. It was a very big deal. No one within hailing distance had a radio set to hear it. So it was just a publicity stunt.
So I was obsessed with radio as a teenager. Like before talk radio was a thing, I lived in New York City. I was an insomniac and I listened to Larry King, who did the first nationwide kind of overnight broadcast. And my grandmother, who was also an insomniac, listened to talk radio, which was like the good guys on 570 AM. And she also listened at night. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to get on the radio station and like try to be a disc jockey. So I went to the University of Chicago, and there was a radio station at the University of Chicago, which was on, would broadcast out of the Reynolds Club at 57th and University. And my dorm was on 60th and Wood and Ellis, which was about 750 feet as the crow flew, maybe. Maybe a little long, maybe 1,000, about 750 feet. And you could not pick up the signal
perfect
of the University of Chicago radio station in my dorm. And then I said to myself, I'm not going to do that. What's the point? And that was, and then I just, you know, it's like the road not taken. If that station had a better broadcast signal, maybe I would have like obsessed over the radio station, and then I would have ended up, you know, doing color commentary for the Kansas City Royals, like Rush Limbaugh.
It's funny you say that, because Al Michaels, the great Al Michaels, who went to Arizona State University, credits the fact that no one could get the broadcast with how he developed into a great sports broadcaster, because nobody was listening. He wasn't getting criticism or feedback, and he spent 4 years broadcasting all of the games into, basically said, you know, you couldn't get it in the basement of the girls' dorm. And so he credits that. So the roads we take and the stories we tell ourselves to make it, to make them true.
Exactly.
Okay. Are you ready for the front page?
Absolutely.
Okay. Since Eliana's not here, I can go directly to my all the time obsession, which is political news coverage. And this is a story that we have been around, we have talked about before, which is the question of what's the right amount of mainstream media stuff for a Republican, for an aspirant Republican candidate? And we should not be surprised that Kevin Williamson wrote a very smart piece about this for the Dispatch, which I cannot open because I don't have Chrome downloaded on my iPad. But as I move over to Safari to open it up, oh no, I'm sorry, this is David Drucker, my other valued colleague. Oh, and also because Eliana's not here, I'm plugging the Dispatch right off the top. But here's what Drucker says. Republican suspicion of mainstream reporters goes back for decades. President Richard Nixon was famously hostile to the press, and when President George H.W. Bush sought re-election in 1992, one of the bumper stickers read, "Annoy the media, re-elect Bush." But the party tolerated the media because it was a conduit for reaching voters. The incentive structure is now different. Demonizing the media helps win the support of grassroots conservatives even more than it used to. And there are plenty of alternatives to the mainstream. In the primary in which Trump could have 25 to 35% of the GOP base locked up, depending on the state, and with DeSantis becoming dominant among grassroots conservatives, it's automatically a losing proposition to fight for the same electorate they command on Fox News or perhaps Newsmax, Breitbart, The Daily Wire, or The Federalist. Candidates looking to carve a competitive lane and make themselves a factor in the race have to venture outside of the conservative media to attract a winning coalition. So I take Brother Drucker's point of view to be, yes, what works for Ron DeSantis is not doing mainstream. But if you're not Ron DeSantis, you probably have to do mainstream to get there. And by the way, as proof of concept, I watched Glenn Youngkin do a town hall on education with Jake Tapper. It was pretty good, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was that was a perilous space for Governor Fleecevest to go into, and he handled it with aplomb, and CNN seemed inclined to ask good questions. What are your thoughts?
I never think that it's a good look for people to avoid things that are difficult for them, particularly in politics. I think you need to engage with the difficulty and battle the difficulty and overcome the difficulty. And sometimes that takes a perverse angle. In the case of Ron DeSantis in particular, his extremely combative press office's rejection of any interaction with the mainstream media, while understandable, I think can convey a sense of weakness or fear or an inability or a lack of faith in his ability to convey his message despite the hostility of his interlocutor. Similarly, whereas I think DeSantis is very responsive, or his team, to social media to his detriment, that his people live in the Twitter echo chamber, particularly the right-wing Twitter echo chamber. And depending on how you feel about what he said earlier this week about Ukraine and whether it's a, you know, national interest of ours and all of that, I think it's pretty clear that that statement that he made, that he gave to Tucker Carlson, was almost crafted with an eye toward a certain type of voice on social media. And I'm sorry, but he's playing on a national stage. How many people are going to vote in the Republican primaries? 35 million, I think.
Oh, that'd be high. Something like that.
Is that high? Let's say somewhere between 25 and 40 million, depending on how like vivid and sharp the battles are. Well, the social media, conservative social media world is a good, you know, sort of like vanguard, I suppose. But he's got to be somebody that those people come to know intimately and well over time, that they're comfortable with, that they're interested in hearing what he has to say. And comforting yourself by staying within your bubble is not a good play. It isn't a good political instinct, though I understand it. I hate debate. I don't like getting, you know, in ugly disputes with people in public and all of that. But I just think it's foolish.
I think that it was certainly true for Ron DeSantis that a risk-averse, friendly media strategy had a lot of merit to it. But there is risk also in home teamism. So if you find yourself answering a questionnaire from Tucker Carlson tonight where you're going to state your opinion on the Ukraine war, you're already in a pretty bad spot, right? Because the politically, the correct answer is, I don't fill out forms, is what I don't do. I'm not running for school board, and you're not the League of Women Voters. I'm not filling out a questionnaire for you to run for president, is number one. Number two, DeSantis ended up, or he and his staff ended up crafting a splay-footed, it's MAGA-y nationalism, or it's in the language of MAGA-y nationalism, but without articulating a substantive policy. There's a lot of straw men in it. It was, I guess I will say, it was certainly enough to make anxious mainstream Republicans who are hoping that DeSantis could be the guy who would beat Trump. It was enough to make them anxious, but certainly not enough to persuade anybody who is now voting for Donald Trump or inclined to support Donald Trump. There's nothing in it that would make them say, oh, well, I guess I like DeSantis better. So it seemed kind of like, I think it illustrates Drucker's point and your point, which is there is no risk-free media strategy.
Right. Well, I think also it's impossible. I want to go back to this Twitter social media thing, because we have a very good counterexample in how to deal with Twitter and social media with the sitting president of the United States, who crafted a strategy for running for president that began in early 2019, in which he had his eye on the prize, right? The idea was he was normalcy. He was going to restore normalcy. There was a crazy person in the White House, and he was going to restore normalcy. All along the way, even as he was leading in the polls by double digits, almost from the time he entered the race, there were constant efforts to knock him off his message through the pressure of social media to respond to the story of the day, the controversy of the day, the progressive desire of the day. And you saw almost every other candidate in that race mistake the social media, you know, jackal pack for the interests and concerns of mainstream Americans.
Yes.
And jump on things and say, I'm going to ban even more guns. No,
Julian
I'm going
Castro
to arrest
and
anybody.
And Beto O'Rourke.
But I mean, it wasn't just, it was Beto O'Rourke. It was Kristen Gillibrand. It was Kamala Harris. You know, I'm going to take everybody's tax dollar, you know, like whatever, however it went. And Biden was like, I'm not responding in this ecosystem. I'm after bigger fish. I'm going somewhere else. And I think it's a little disturbing that DeSantis, who, I mean, disturbing is not the right word exactly. It is telling that DeSantis is jumping into the ecosystem rather than saying, look, I'm already a national figure. I am running neck and neck to a little behind of Trump. And, you know, I don't need to, I need to be on a national stage. And Twitter, whatever Twitter is, even though Trump loved Twitter and all of that, Twitter is not a national stage. It is a stage in which 2-3% of the people in the United States sets the agenda in many ways, but it's 2-3 are like involved. Just like Tucker Carlson tonight, 3 million people watch Tucker Carlson tonight. That's an amazing achievement. There are 330 million people in the United States, and 155 million of them voted in November 2020. What is 3 into 155?
I was told there would be no math.
It's like, of course you want Tucker Carlson to like you, and you want his audience to like you. It's better that they like you than that they don't like you. But if you're playing for all the marbles, don't let these people control your brain.
Right.
Your brain is supposed to lead them. That's what it means to be a leader, is you're not slavishly, you know, you don't build a coalition by saying, I mean, you do, a lot of people do this, but I'm going to give you this, I'm going to give you that, I'm going to give you the other thing. You have to have a larger purpose. And I think he does, DeSantis, but politically, and maybe this is not really, this is a media show, but politically, he is the candidate for everybody who isn't going to vote for Trump.
Right.
So
his appeal has to be to the other 60% of the Republican Party.
Yeah. And, you know, even if a lot of that 60% is kind of okay with Trump, or, you know, they don't have the regnant hostility to Trump that a lot of other people have, but it's like he's it makes him look small time, and it makes him look like he's like somebody who is pursuing a beloved rather than saying, come to me and make you whole.
As they would say in Hollywood, sexy indifference. You've got to have a little sexy indifference to the part.
Right. Yeah.
People, Americans want people who don't need power. They want to give power to people who don't seem like they need it.
Now, on the sexy question, indifference is a good, can I just make another analogy here? So the sexy,
who knows more about thing? Sexiness than you and me, my friend?
No one, really. We're out there. This is Oceans 2. We are, Clooney and Damon.
There's our title.
Here we are. Yeah. DeSantis's people don't have to be so angry if the Washington Post asks for an interview.
Right.
Washington Post says, can we interview you? And then they proudly send back a copy of the email that they respond where they say no, period, nothing else. What are you being so obnoxious for? George W. Bush, running for president in 1999, did not give interviews for most of 1999. By the way, to his detriment, because when he started coming out, he looked like an idiot. He sounded like an idiot. And he gave McCain space. And it's not, I mean, McCain ultimately didn't prevail, obviously, but he made Bush sweat a lot. And Bush was in a prohibitively powerful position. But I think he even made a mistake by not engaging with the press for so long. But when he didn't engage with them, he was perfectly polite about it. He was perfectly pleasant about it. It was, I'm listening. I'm taking meetings. I want to hear what other people have to say. I'm not ready to talk about these things until I'm really sure, yada-da-da-da. Like, DeSantis sounds like he's got a chip on his shoulder when somebody says, hey, could I ask you a question for a second? It's like, no. Be a little more positive about yourself.
In politics, like all of life, it is hard to know when to pivot from the thing that got you where you are to the thing that will take you where you want to be. It is hard to give that up. Speaking of hard to give it up. So many, many, many pixels have been murdered in the name of learning the lessons of Donald Trump in 2016 for the mainstream media, for the press, at Fox News, at any number of places. No, we're not going to repeat the same mistakes with Donald Trump that we did before. And lo and behold, open up Politico. Trump prepares an extensive opposition file on, quote, Ron DeSanctimonious. Now, you've gotten oppo in your career. I've gotten oppo. Any campaigns that want to dump some oppo with me, I'm here. Send it over. I want it. Yes, please. And if it's good and relevant and germane, I will use it. And I don't even have to tell who gave it. If I can back it up, if I can go find the court file or I can find whatever else, it's fine. This is a normal thing. Opposition research is a normal thing. This piece at Politico, though, says it's a meta opposition research dump. It's a story about opposition research, which is crazy cakes, because what they're doing is they're allowing Trump's team to dump on DeSantis and float a bunch of trial balloons. Like, oh, we may say that he's a groomer. We may say this. And sort of these unsubstantiated allegations that they're considering leveling against DeSantis and what their narrative is. How can you be so used? This is Meredith McGraw wrote the piece. Talk about getting taken for a ride. That's not how you do that. And I thought that was remarkable. And then here's the Washington Post headline, following, running right alongside Politico, as usual, the Washington Post. On the trail, freewheeling Donald Trump counters scripted Ron DeSantis. What's that you say? Do you mean to say that Donald Trump, he's shooting from the hip? He's out there. He's loose. He's relaxed. He's very entertaining. That old Ron DeSantis, he's so scripted compared to Donald Trump. I'm sorry. How is any of that news, right? How is that, like, Donald Trump's unscriptedness is, we know, we've seen it. This is not something that is germane. And then letting Trump's campaign just dump on DeSantis uncritically, I'm not seeing a lot of lessons learned about how to deal with Donald Trump.
The question is this, because this has been basically a dominating issue inside liberal newsrooms and mainstream media news organizations from November 8th, 2016 onward, which is, what did we do to give this guy the oxygen that made it possible right for him, the person we fear most in the history of America, to have become president? And a lot of different answers have been, some of them totally exculpatory of the media, like the Russians did it, Cambridge Analytica, Facebook did it. It's not us. Facebook did it. Yep. Got him elected, and we, you know, now we will prevent future disinformation campaigns that control people's minds. That's, we're noble, and we're, democracy dies in darkness. We're going to shine a light on this and all of that, right? So they go there, and then they also go to, what did we do? We didn't say that he was a liar enough. We didn't say that he was this enough. We didn't say he was that enough. And you and I know what it was that got Donald Trump elected, right? It was this combination of baiting the media,
yes,
and being served by the media,
yes,
that just took all the oxygen out of the room for everybody else.
$3 billion worth of unpaid media time.
Right.
And well, whether it's negative or whether it's positive, Trump, the veteran of the New York tabloid wars, the person behind the headline, "Best Sex I Ever Had" in the New York Post about Marla Maples, was able to do the jujitsu and use the publicity and use the time. People have heard me talk often about the time that Donald Trump reenacted an attempted murder perpetrated by Ben Carson in Fort Dodge, Iowa. The attempted murder was in Philadelphia. The recreation was in front of a bunch of very alarmed-looking Lutherans in Fort Dodge, Iowa. So he was talking about how Ben Carson is lying about being an attempted murderer, and that in fact he's soft on attempted murder. It was amazingly good television. Everybody wanted to watch it. I couldn't look away, and I understand. What's funny to me is, number one, the outsized role that people in our business want to give themselves in either A, creating Trump, but more likely that if only we had done more. And I always go back to the 2016 piece on the front page of the New York Times, which basically said Trump represents a, it was the media column, Trump represents an asymmetrical threat to democracy, ergo, we must break the rules of journalism to cover him. They did, and it didn't make any difference, and if anything, probably helped Trump.
Right. So we are engaged now in a massive behavioral experiment.
Yes.
For the media as 2023 proceeds and 24 proceeds. What Trump's appearance in East Palestine and the speech that he made a couple of weeks ago, what they demonstrate is that any hopes that anti-Trump forces may have had that he's off his game and he's run out of steam and he's going to be as boring and as bad as he was in his presidential announcement speech in that ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, and that he was kind of going to do himself in, it's probably not going to happen. He's still there. He's older, and maybe he'll make mistakes and stuff like that, but he's still getting, he's still getting shots of adrenaline from the crowd, and he's still able to walk around in a world with people who are dazzled by his presence, who look like exactly the voters that he wants to win. And he's not going to make it easy on the media that would like to move past him and would like it to be organic so that they're not called upon to have to make hard choices about what things of his to cover. Do you go live with one of his speeches? Because, of course, he is the leading contender for the presidential nomination in one of the two leading parties. That's by definition news, right? I mean, that's news. It's that's maybe
Functions as running as an incumbent. He's a weak incumbent, but he functions as the incumbent. And how do you cover the incumbent?
So you're going to have to make very hard choices and make hard decisions. And the people, I think, that this is going to be of most interest and very complicated interest, your old employer and my old friends at Fox. It's pretty clear that there has been a corporate decision made by News Corp to side with Ron DeSantis. What people don't realize, but you know, is that there was a corporate decision at Fox in 2015 to not try to favor Trump in the primaries. And you had you had Megyn Kelly asking hard questions. You had Rupert, in the background, clearly not liking Trump, a lot of ideas about whether or not they should give a lot of oxygen to Rubio, whatever. Roger Ailes didn't like Trump. But at the same time, he had helped make Trump by giving him this weekly gig on the Fox Morning Show. And at some point, it became clear that there was going to be no salvation from Trump. No one was going to deliver the Republican Party from Trump.
If you tell people subtly, and I think this is true at Fox and other places, you send the cues, this is not who we want, we shouldn't do this again. But then you say explicitly, your ratings better not go down. Right? You had better...
Yeah, you can't have both.
Your clicks and ratings had better not go down. But sotto voce, you're saying, we don't really like this person and it's probably bad, so you might want to do this. But then you say, if your ratings go down, you'll lose your job. It does not take long for the talent and for producers to say, if Trump rates, we're going with Trump. And that's that. I think you've nailed it. Washington Post headline. Much of the 2024 GOP field focuses on dark, apocalyptic themes. So just fun. Just the Post is just checking in with a little bit of funster here. Eliana sent this one in, and it does capture that point of view that while the Democrats are focused on sweetness and light, Joe Biden is just all Mr. Positivity. These Republicans, Ashley Parker says, are focused on the apocalypse.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the general message of the Democratic Party in 2022 and obviously in 2024. That's such a positive message because it's going to be, if you don't vote us in, that is the end of our democracy.
And the planet.
That's it. The planet is dead and our democracy is dead. And so that's not apocalyptic at all. What is the apocalyptic message of the Republican Party. It's this. It is like, you people are trying to redefine gender. These people are trying to destroy our educational system by elevating racial composition and bad ideas about the founding of America and all of that. You're trying to destroy the educational system. You're trying to redefine gender and whatever else. Is that exactly apocalyptic? The Democratic message is maybe the Democratic message is necessarily and properly apocalyptic if you believe what they believe. But you can't then say, oh, these Republicans, they're just so extreme in their feelings about the threat to the future of America. Every presidential campaign, each party implicitly says the other party is going to destroy America, except for 1 year. There's only 1 year I can think of that was not the case, which was 1996, when you had Bill Clinton saying, I'm going to take driver's licenses away from deadbeat dads. And you had Bob Dole saying, I'm going to take us back to a better time when I was younger. And then we can all live in the world that I lived in the 1950s. And none of that was the low stakes election of all time. In every other election I can think of, the idea is America's, 2000. Yeah.
2000 Social Security lockbox and what to do with the surplus and how to scale back okay. American foreign.
That was pretty low stakes too. I agree. So those two elections. Stakes. Yeah. But after that, yeah.
Al Sharpton has the answer, John. Yes. As usual, Reverend Al has the answer. So this has been a recurring theme on the podcast. We have talked about the befuddlement on the left about Republicans don't even know what woke means. They don't even understand what woke means, and they're attacking woke, and no one knows what it means. And did you know that it has been culturally appropriated from Black people? And so it's kind of even racist to say woke in a negative way, and what does woke mean? And it's all a big mystery. So let's listen to Al Sharpton's answer on this.
Americans have different views.
Absolutely,
on woke.
Yeah.
And what I always say to people when they start talking about woke, well, what's the opposite? Sleep? You rather? And I think you changed the argument. Do you want to be woke or do you want to be sleep?
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, John. I think we now know what the Democrats can do, which is they can say sleep. You're not woke. You're sleep. So I think the matter's concluded.
I think when Al Sharpton lost those 150 pounds, which is really, I think you and I can both agree, was an extraordinarily remarkable achievement.
Yeah, totally impressive.
He also lost a few steps on his rhetorical talents. That is some lame stuff. I do think, Chris, I would like to ask you.
Yeah.
There's been this move in the last 4 or 5 days, op-eds, various other pieces, particularly because people were blaming, people on the right were trying to connect the failure of the Silicon Valley Bank to woke policies pursued by the Silicon Valley Bank, that the word woke should really be retired. It's time to get rid of the word woke. Republicans don't even know what it means, and did woke, it's so this and that. So I assume from this onslaught against the word woke, that this is really working. That in fact,
100%.
That in fact, the rubric of woke, however you want to define it, you may not. It's sort of like what Justice Powell who said of pornography. I don't know how to define it, but I know what it is when I see it. Everybody knows what woke is when they see it, even if they can't come up with a pithy definition of what it is.
And I think Americans used to use the term politically correct for the same category, but it is an obsessive or unhealthy focus on questions of social justice and that kind of political correctness. And again, a recurring theme here is words mean what we say they mean at different times, right? So the word gay means something different than it meant before. Or we can talk about the struggle over were we experiencing inflation 2 years ago? And people say, well, see, it's not actually inflation. You think it's inflation. And it's like, well, yeah, but people know what they think the word inflation means. And it means that stuff costs more. And people know what woke means. And I find the idea of Democrats digging in on defending woke and trying to take that back and not let it be co-opted is a huge mistake, right? This is a terrible mistake because they have to let it go and laugh at Republicans who use it, not try to reclaim it or right. argue the semantics of it.
You know, it reminds me of the 84 and 88 campaigns, again, showing my age here. But, you know, there was this point where this remarkable thing happened in American politics as Reaganism became more successful and sort of became the sort of the dominating force, was that the word liberal, which was a positive term in American politics for most of the 20th century, there was a turn. And the word liberal in many places started being a bad word. And there were these hilarious, Arthur Finkelstein, who was a consultant in New York, made commercials, was sort of the father of the attack, of the certain type of attack ad. A guy named Buddy McKay was running for either senator or governor of Florida, I can't remember. And the ad was, "You're liberal, Buddy McKay. Yeah. You're a liberal." Like that. It wasn't like, "You're a liberal because you believe in this. You're a liberal because you want that." It was just enough to say that he was a liberal. And then the question was, would Buddy McKay say, "I'm not a liberal. I'm not right. a liberal." Or would he say, "You're damn right, I'm a liberal." You know, either way, yes. he was caught in a pincer, right?
That's right.
So in this sense, and then there was all this, how dare you, you know, talk this way about liberalism? Why liberalism is the greatest, it's noble, it's free speech, like that. And it's like, just keep going on like that with your self-righteousness, because the reason it's working is that the American people, or enough people in America in certain places, feel this way about the word liberal and liberalism. And you're just reinforcing their feeling about this and doing the work of the very people that you're trying to get to stop doing this. And in fact, until 2008, I believe Barack Obama said in 2007, "I am a liberal." And that was like, whoa, he admits that he is a liberal. Like, no Democratic politician practically anywhere in the country would actually even use the word liberal in connection to them. So my sense is that wokeness, which is a relatively new term, by the way, is the liberal of our time. And yeah, you're really dumb to get into the sandbox on this, because you're just going to reinforce why people hate wokeness and convince a lot of people in the middle that this woke thing is, that's very up. I don't like it when you do that. Like, just go somewhere else, drop it. Like,
right.
Find just other terminology for yourself.
That's right. And words like equal protection, fairness, inclusiveness, those words are not freighted and people respond well to them. If you need, yeah. And I think maybe the short answer is, don't take political advice from Al Sharpton. This is not what to do. You do not take political advice from Al Sharpton. Okay, another follow-up file. We talked here a while ago about the journey of Rod Dreher, who did Andrew Sullivan's podcast. He's moved to Hungary. He's into Viktor Orban and all of this stuff. But he always had a platform at the American Conservative, which is, I guess we'd call a paleocon, if that term still matters. But he a long time had a perch at the American Conservative. And his benefactor, according to Vanity Fair, his benefactor, Howard Amundson Jr., who bankrolled his salary and paid for his position there after things got a little weird on his entries, that they've pulled the plug on him. So that is his journey continues. Okay, on to Silicon Valley Bank. On to Silicon Valley Bank. Okay, here is the most shame-resistant headline of them all on Silicon Valley Bank from Politico. How Biden saves Silicon Valley startups inside the 72 hours that transformed U.S. banking. Now, look, I'm not an economic expert. I'm not a financial reporter. I don't know enough about this to speak authoritatively. But I'm going to bet that Joe Biden did not save Silicon Valley startups. And I'm going to bet that the 72 hours did not transform American banking. I observed there was a, and our readers will correct me, our listeners will correct me if I'm wrong. I see this as significant, but an isolated incident of a extraordinarily poorly managed bank, of somebody who didn't take normal and appropriate steps to guard against risk and blew it, right? That you had bad leadership, bank blew it, whatever. May have been a bigger deal. Certainly it would have been bad if Joe Biden would have come out in a tank top and said, stuff your money under the mattresses. It's time. Be afraid. Go down to Mr. Potter's. He's given 75 cents on the dollar. That probably would have been bad. But the coverage of this seemed to me to reflect a yearning for disaster and across the board, and certainly in some corners of the mainstream, a desire to give Biden a lot more credit than maybe he was due. Am I being cynical?
I don't think you're being cynical at all. First of all, that headline is a double-edged sword, because if banking was transformed in those 72 hours, the likeliest transformation is a bad one, not a good one. Right. You could say that maybe the liquidity of the American banking system was saved for the present moment by this intervention, but the transformation of American banking was the decision to lift the federal government's, or the FDIC's, responsibility to depositors at this one, actually at two banks, this one, I think it's Signature Bank, from 250,000 to 8 squillion, kajillion, zillion, or to infinity, and that they were going to make these depositors whole no matter what, even though all banking, everyone in banking understands that you have this protection and that it's limited to $250,000. If other banks fail and other stuff happens in the next, you know, whatever period, there is going to be a liquidity crisis at the FDIC, because you cannot have the federal, you cannot, whether or not fees, banking fees pay for it, you can't have every bank in the world having its deposits protected to infinity. And that is the logic of what's happened here. You can say it only stops at these two banks, but if the bank of, you know, Podunk fails, oh, you're really not going to protect those depositors? Right. Really? Just because these
the
guys are
Podunk,
these
yes.
guys may you know, work at Uber, they get to have their money protected. And so you have that classic moral hazard. So in that sense, it's a double-edged sword. They want to praise the Biden administration, but in fact, the jury is way out on whether this was wise or sound or good. And the second point I want to make is, what evidence is there that Biden, quote unquote, had anything whatsoever right. to do with this? From what we know, this is basically a Fed decision in conjunction with people at the Treasury Department and the FDIC. Now, the Treasury Department is part of the Biden administration, and I'm sure people at the White House were getting updates, and Biden had to say something on Monday morning. But you think Biden was materially involved in figuring out
green eye shade up in the residence
bank and dealing with the question of people who were, might have been proposing to take the bank over but didn't have the requisite amount of capital, or they didn't want this? He wasn't involved. Biden had nothing to do with this. That's not the way it worked. And the hunger to kind of give, even if you want to use the word Biden as a synecdoche for the entire right. administration, which I guess is fair. The headline gives the misleading impression that Joe Biden was himself sitting there on the phone, or, you know, like running the argument in the room like Phil Hartman as Reagan creating the Iran-Contra scandal.
After he shows the Girl Scouts like out of the room and then pulls down the map of Iran. Okay, boys, let's go.
You're sending, get that deposit over to the Sultan of Brunei, you know, like that, while seeming like a doddering old fool. So that's part of the
Brandon energy. Yes.
Yeah. That's part of the weirdness of the way Biden's coverage has gone since he had the political successes in the summer of 2022, like the Inflation Reduction Act and stuff like that, which is suddenly he's so competent. And all of the things that he is given credit for, we really have no reason to think that he personally had anything to do with. Of course, he gets blamed if things go wrong, so maybe he should get credit when things go well by his own lights, but journalists are supposed to know better, I think.
Well, the one of the things that Biden really has going for him, and we will not do another 2024 round here, but just that Biden is able to do things like open up or allow Conoco to stop suing ConocoPhillips, to end the litigation with ConocoPhillips, to allow Conoco to go drill in the Willow Reserve in Alaska, to veto or to assign the overturning of the D.C. City Council's cuckoo bananas crime law, and all these other things that are being marked as moves to the center. Biden is working on an enormous reservoir of good wishes and goodwill, because the press may not know how to handle Donald Trump in terms of covering Donald Trump, but they know how to handle Donald Trump when it comes to Joe Biden, which is to say, Dark Brandon, he is the train track hero, not the public transportation hero that America wanted, but the public transportation hero that America needed.
Right.
Barney Frank, and I'm actually coming to you from inside Barney Frank's former home in Washington, D.C., as a little point of historical interest.
Okay, you got to stop right there. I'm sorry. Was this the home that he lived in 1989?
Yes.
Because you remember what happened in Barney Frank's home in 1989.
Yes, and I'm not open for business down here.
You know what?
Don't send your friends.
Barney Frank wasn't open for business, but his boyfriend was open for business and ran a call boy ring out of Barney Frank's apartment on Capitol Hill.
It was a different time on Capitol Hill in those days than it is now. So Barney Frank, there was a lot of coverage and surprise. The Wall Street Journal story on it is good. Barney Frank pushed to ease financial regulations after joining Signature Bank board. And there's been a lot of blame casting back and forth. It's Biden's fault. No, it's really Trump's fault. Glenn Greenwald and others said, no, the Democrats didn't act quickly enough to restore these restrictions. So it's really their fault because they wasted their opportunity. And it has been mostly useless. But there has been a little accountability for Barney Frank here about that. And I want to credit Eliana Flagg this. And I want to credit the Washington Post in May of 2018. Talked about his joining the Signature Bank board. Talked about his reversals here and talked about the potential consequences. And they called it, they nailed it, and they held Barney Frank, who often was treated as sort of a mascot by the Washington press, right? It's sort of like he's adorable kind of thing about Barney Frank. Not to say that he's not adorable to the people who love him, but that Barney Frank was not taken seriously in a lot of ways. And I think that had to do, I'm sure, with being the first openly gay congressman. He has a pugnacious, humorous manner about him, that Lowell Mass energy and all of that stuff. But the Washington Post took him seriously as a lobbyist, and what they foresaw, what they foretold, came to pass.
It is a good story, and the Barney Frank story is an indication that the temptations of K Street, though of course it's not like Signature Bank is on K Street, but that the temptations of taking what you learn in government or being a person in government and then crossing the street and then literally betraying your own signature piece of legislation for a payout, that's pretty blatant. Like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the only thing I can analogize it to is Michael Flynn selling his expertise to enemies of, you know, selling his presence to enemies of the United States after having served the United States in the military and then in senior positions in intelligence agencies. But of course, you know, Flynn was fired and believed himself to have been hard done wrong and therefore, you know, had some emotional ballast for doing what he did and the need for money. And Barney Frank, the only thing he will be remembered for 75 years from now is having his name on this piece of financial legislation in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, Dodd-Frank. And then 7 years after it passes, he's out trying to weaken it for the almighty dollar. You know, it's like if you were a prosecutor and you prosecuted someone and got him the death penalty, and then you quit the prosecution's office and then you went and became his defense attorney and claim
and use the knowledge that
meant
you had.
That he should be, yes, and his and there should and he should not get the he should be, you know, the death penalty should be that should be struck down to a 25-year sentence. Like, you can't do that. Like, you know, Barney Frank did something you kind of can't do, and he's going to get excoriated.
One of the most common allegations in Washington is that people, whether they be lobbyists or think tanks or whomever, are taking positions for payola, right? You're only saying this because you're funded, but you know, you only wrote this report about dog food safety because you're in the pocket of Big Kibble. That's the only reason that you did it. And most of the time, people are mistaken because the money finds the ideas more than the ideas find the money, right? Most of the time, what people get paid for is having opinions that the people with the money like, and they find those people, and it's generally not changing their opinions. Now, there's the gradual corruption that happens in people over time. They hang out in the acid bath long enough, and it corrupts them, right? They the proximity to power and the proximity to wealth corrupts, and that's the way it is. So, fine. Barney Frank's story is the story that people actually decry, right? He changed his point of view for money. And that is not the way to do it. Like, you got to just be who you are, because there's no bank, right? You don't get to do enough good deeds in your own mind or the eyes of your supporters, whatever you think about Dodd-Frank. Many people thought it was a good thing to do. You don't get to store up enough treasure in your reputational treasure that then you can say, okay, boys, let's start cashing it in. Now it's time. And now it's time to trade on it, because it doesn't remain. It all goes away. Okay. Guess what? It's time for the business page. Politico has turmoil. Politico, which is now a property of Axel Springer, the German media giant that took over, and their celebrity executive editor, I shouldn't say celebrity, but their high-profile executive editor, Daphne Linzer, Washington Post headline, abruptly steps down, said the Post with some relish about the situation, and her conflict with Kaminsky, her boss, and the two of them at Loggerheads. Dylan Byers at Puck has a very interesting write-up on this about the tension inside the organization, and we've talked before about there were like speech codes that were put in place at Politico, and those got yanked back. And there seems to be a lot of Sturm und Drang at Politico. Is this, do you figure, growing pains and just transition pains? Is there something else going on here?
Well, look, so Springer paid a huge amount of money for Politico. So I view this and its CEO, Matthias Dorfner, like he came in and they paid, I don't know, $300-500 million, some really like mind-blowing.
Like $1 billion. Yeah.
Is it a billion? Okay, so you paid a mind-blowing amount of money. So basically, I look at this in the long run as this, which is they can hire and fire whoever they want, and people can quit or not quit. She abruptly stepped down. Sometimes when the phrase abruptly stepped down is described in terms of a personnel change, the stepping down may have involved somebody putting a hand on the back and doing a little push that forces the step down. We don't know what the story is here. But one of the interesting aspects here is that Politico went for a lot of money. Axios, some of these follow-on organizations, these Washington newly created non-print journalistic organizations, there is a wild gold rush on in relation to them. They are the people at Axios, I think, are viewed as having experienced massive liquidity events in their life. I think it's Axios where Jim Vandehei and Mike Allen.
I'm surprised Colin Ciccola still produces this podcast. He used to work there. I assume he's doing this bobbing in a yacht somewhere in off Sag Harbor. Yeah.
But from what we know, like these guys who are basically were just workaday working journalists in Washington over the last 20 years and with very good reputations and serious positions at places are now, you know, like they're in the top 0.1% of American earners and wealth holders because of their connection to these new organizations. We're sitting here looking at the newspaper business having cratered. the old media having cratered, but these new media organizations are like earning colossal returns for the people who started them and their founders. And there's going to be a lot of turmoil in them as a result. People don't really understand this. Like, so suddenly it's like, what did I do? I paid $1 billion for this thing. And right. I've now looked under the hood and I'm not quite sure where I'm going to get $200 million in revenue. So Daphna Linzer, according to this story, is like, you all have to write more stories. Like, that's, you know, that's really, that's going to make the marginal difference. Like, her bosses are putting pressure on her to make more money. And they, BuzzFeed, another story that you
yeah, yeah. flagged you, you, my attention. You teed
BuzzFeed
it up
is
perfectly.
Now pushing everybody to write more stories. And all that is fine. But, you know, if you're talking about valuations in the hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, that's not what's going to bring in the bacon.
Wall Street Journal headline, BuzzFeed encourages reporters to write more stories in attempt to turn profit. Alexandra Burrell says BuzzFeed Inc. is encouraging its newsroom to produce more articles in an effort to boost traffic as its news division continues to lose money and the digital publisher braces for continuing declines in revenue. BuzzFeed says it published 404 articles in February, a 24% decrease from the year earlier period. It reduced the size of its roughly 100-person newsroom by about 40%. So they cut the newsroom staff by 40 people, and the story production is only down 24%. So as a person who, at times in my career, would write 5 or 6 stories in a day working for small market newspapers. Get ready. If you work at BuzzFeed, strap in and make sure that you have a desk close to the men's room because you're gonna be there. You're going to be spending a lot of time shackled to the desk. And of course, the quality goes down, right? That's necessarily what happens when you cut your staff by 40% and then tell them that they have to write even more so that they, because listeners probably know this, but there is a bad model in the news business, which is it's casting a net. It's not clickbait even. It's net casting. You're just throwing URLs out there. You're generating headlines and URLs in the hopes that somehow if you just throw enough out there and you drag that net in, that you'll get some clicks along the way. And it's grim. And publications that find themselves at this point don't usually recover, right? This is not like, okay, this is a quick rebound. And if your solution is crank it out, boys, you get in there, I'm reminded of one of my favorite jokes, the Roman galley slaves, the guys beating the drum, and the overseer comes down and says, fellas, I got good news and I got bad news. Good news is there is an extra double ration of gruel tonight. Hooray, the cheer goes up. This is great, gruel. And they say, the bad news is the captain wants to go water skiing. So get ready to go water skiing, BuzzFeed. Relatedly, and this hurts my heart, this is from the Nieman Lab, talking about the consequences in newsrooms about what's happening with the demise of Gannett. At the end of 2018, the last full pre-merger year, the two companies had roughly 24,000 employees in the United States and 27,600 worldwide. By December 31st, 2019, the combined company was down to 21,000 employees in the U.S. By the end of 2020, it had dropped to 18,000. A year later, 13,000. And in its most recent SEC filing, reports that as of the end of the year 2022, Gannett had just 11,200 employees remaining. So the consequences in local news for what's going on here is really freaking dire, right? Because those are newsroom jobs. The jobs that are lost, look, a lot of those are in production jobs or print jobs for places that are doing less print and all of that stuff. But those are a lot of newsroom jobs. And those are not newsroom jobs here in Washington or there in New York. Those are in small markets where now county commissions and school boards are not going to get covered and the basic work is not going to get done. And we've talked on this podcast a lot about what might be done, about how this might, what might go on. And there are some solutions being offered, but we should remember that the business, the market failures in local journalism have consequences.
Look, this is a very important story, but there is also, I don't know if there's an answer to it, but one of the things that happened over the course of the last 15 years, actually, of course, the last 30 years, is that the newspapers had what you might call the TV advertising model, which is to say that they were close to being free to their readers. You know, the Washington Post cost a quarter when I lived in Washington. You know, they printed 100 newsprint pages a day or more. Like,
yeah,
that didn't cover the cost of the paper because they were giving it to you for a nominal fee because they were making their money off the ads and the classifieds. So the classifieds went away because of the internet and Craigslist, and then the ads over time went away, and the readers then were still paying the equivalent of a quarter. So, you know, 75% of their revenue was gone, and it's not coming back. What is the story that the internet has taught us over the last 10 years that relates to Politico and Axios and BuzzFeed and all of that, which is there are two other models to follow, one of which is you actually ask your readers to pay for the product. And instead of saying that it's a dollar for the paper, it's $5 a day for the paper. How many people can pay for that? Not that many, granted, particularly in small, but that's real revenue. And those are people who, because they will pay it, are invested in the topic and the subject and things that they want. And even if your readership declines by 2/3, you will probably end up making more money off the smaller readership. And that smaller readership is going to be interested and invested in exactly the kind of reporting yes. that you're talking about, which is how, what's going on in our town? How can we save it? What is government doing here? What is the state government doing, interfering in what we do in our city and all of that? And you can get a lot of bang for your buck out of that, as long as you're willing to adjust the model. And the thing about the newspaper business is they have not adjusted the model. All they've done is cost cut because they've had revenue cuts rather than completely revisit how they do business. And Gannett is a very badly run company. And obviously Alden Capital, which bought up all these small papers, is a very badly run business in the sense that maybe it's just making money off zombifying its these papers. I don't quite understand how that works with the debt play.
Well, and if but you keep closing papers, they closed, here are the closure numbers in 2019. And Gannett merged with Gatehouse, which was another large publisher. That was the second company we were talking about. Owned 261 dailies and 302 weeklies. In 2022, there were down to 217 dailies and 175 weeklies. The loss of those weekly papers is even more pronounced because they're in smaller communities. They have greater consequences. The third quarter 2018 circulation for the 10 largest Gannett newspapers, which include the Detroit Free Press, the Arizona Republic, the Indianapolis Star, Cincinnati Inquirer, for the Sunday paper, which is where their money make their vision, where they're going to make a lot of money, is they're going to shove everything into the Sunday paper, from 1.58 million to 525,000, a 66.8% decrease in circulation. It just won't work, right? Like to your point, John, you cannot cut your way to profitability in news. Because as you damage the product, as you become less relevant to people, and you know this is the rebuilding is happening in places, and there's reason for optimism. But Gannett is a zombie, and it's sad. It is hard to watch. Which was also the name of Tracy Jordan's Oscar bait movie that he made on 30 Rock. Okay. We've got the right man for the job now because it's time for our style section. Okay, we have as one, and if you're not a subscriber to GLOP, the GLOP Culture Podcast, it is a welcome fortnightly arrival in your podcast lineup. It's a great one, and you and Jonah Goldberg and Rob Long are funny and delightful and just mean enough to each other to make it good. Except when the Schmeckel discussion goes on too long, then you got to hit the 30-second advance. Okay, Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't pretend to understand Gwyneth Paltrow. I will say that right now. I don't pretend to understand what is going on. She was born famous and born beautiful. The situation is weird. But she did an interview with a podcast, and this is Page Six wrote it up at the New York Post, wrote it up. And during the interview with this podcast, she confessed to being on an IV, getting nutrient blasted with the appropriate, you know, ketoids or whatever the correct flow was at the time. It sounds like a utterly bizarre interview that she did. John, why do they do this? Why do they talk about this stuff? Where is their correct Howard Hughes-like shame? Why are they not hiding somewhere in a hotel in Las Vegas wearing tissue boxes on their feet? I don't understand.
Okay. She has monetized this stuff. She has a business called Goop that is a weird combination of makeup, holistic healing, quack medical cures, and things like that. And so she is no longer an actor. She barely acts anymore. I think basically she was sort of like Iron Man's girlfriend and then wife, and that was it for her, because she makes more money on Goop, which I think, again, is a company with a valuation well in excess of $1 billion. So this is part of her business to go on these podcasts and talk about how she's doing IVs, because it's all fashion forward. I have two things to say about Gwyneth Paltrow. Number one is personal. I babysat for her when she was 4 years old.
Come on.
I was an apprentice at the Williamstown Theater Festival in 1978, and her mother, Blythe Danner, was a longtime veteran of the Williamstown Theater Festival. And one day I was asked if I would watch Gwynny because her babysitter had to go do something or other. And I played with her in the lobby of the Adams Theater, where 42, 43, 44 years later, my daughter now traipses around as a student at Williams College. So she was really cute, and then once I was getting into a cab in the East Village, and she was getting out of the cab. This is probably 20 years ago, and I said to her, 25 years ago, I said to her, I babysat for you in 1978, and she said,
she maced you. She sprayed you. She sprayed you right then with mace.
No,
she was getting.
She said, "How was I?" And I said, "You were an angel," which is true. So I have very positive feelings for Gwyneth Paltrow for that reason. Personal story. Second story is, she is somebody who suffered from too much success too young, by which I mean,
yes,
she, and I think deservedly, she won an Oscar in 1998 for Shakespeare in Love. That is a glory. I actually happened to watch Shakespeare in Love last week for no particularly good reason. That is a glorious, definitive performance. And it's almost as though she then spent the next 10 years or 12 years or whatever, you know, making movies. And it was like, nothing was ever going to be as good as that. Like she hit her high water mark before she was 30, and she basically got out of Dodge and moved on. And I think that's an interesting thing, even though what she's doing seems absolutely bananas.
So you're saying Tom Hanks was better off to have made Bachelor Party and do Bosom Buddies early, so he had something to grow into. Just, I will say, as for a daily wellness routine, Paltrow revealed she intermittent fasts and eats something, quote, that won't spike her blood sugar around 12 p.m. Quote, I love soup. I have bone broth for a lot of the days. I try to do 1 hour of movement, so I'll go for a walk or do Pilates, or I'll do my Tracy Anderson workouts. This is my favorite line. The Goop founder then dry brushes in the sauna for 30 minutes and has a vegetable-heavy dinner in line with the paleo diet to support her detox. I don't know what dry brushing in the sauna is, but if I was as rich as Gwyneth Paltrow, I would not do it. I don't know what it is, but I would definitely not dry brush myself with anything in a hot wooden room.
Chris, we should put our money where our mouth is here, and maybe you and I should try this. Okay?
Dry brushing.
We don't want our blood sugar to spike at noon. We'll have some bone broth. We don't have a sauna. But we have a vegetable-heavy dinner. We go paleo and keto and this and that. We see where we are in 3 months. We could, look, she's very skinny.
She is
like Al Sharpton skinny.
If I had a cup of bone broth and a vegetable-heavy dinner and scratched myself with branches in a sauna for a half an hour, I would be in prison for the murders that I committed. I would definitely be in prison. Okay, it was Oscar week, right?
Yes.
Is that right? The Oscars were on Sunday.
Yes.
Did they do the right things, by the way? Do you agree
with the whatever. Academy? I mean, I'm too old for Everything Everywhere All at Once, so which won everything, though I thought Michelle Yeoh, its star, was glorious. And so I whatever, you know, it's like it wasn't a movie like Nomadland, which won, you know, 2 years ago, where you see Frances McDormand wandering around America taking a crap in a bucket. So that sense, that was Best Picture 2 years ago. So this is like a real advance on that. Basically, the most important thing about the Oscars is nobody went. This is not something you're going to hear, but basically, like, no, there were no Hollywood stars there. They've given up on the Oscars. Usually, or they just didn't want to be associated after the biggest male star in the world, you know, slapped the biggest stand-up comedian in the world last year. But, you know, nobody was there. Julia Roberts wasn't there. Tom Cruise wasn't there. Tom Hanks wasn't there. Matt Damon wasn't there. Ben Affleck wasn't there. Gwyneth Paltrow wasn't there. Nobody was there. No star was there. And, you know, basically, that's a sign that, you know, look, movies were the dominating cultural force in America for close to a century, and they're kind of over. You know, that's a long time. That's a long time to be the most important popular culture art form, a century, and obviously we're moving on from that to where we gather in a theater, even though theaters are sort of coming back from their worst places. But It's done. You can feel it. It's like, it's not like done like, you know, vaudeville was done in by radio, but it's, you know, it's 10 years from now, I don't even know if there will be an Oscars.
I think it's sort of like print media, which is to say that what was a low end thing will persist, but it was a very high end thing, right? It goes from being free newspapers handed out in the subway to being the Financial Times, and it goes from, so it becomes an elite thing, blah, 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 blah. But Demetria Glace at Slate has another theory. Why are all action heroes named Jack, James, or John? She wants to know. What's up with that, right? So what's going on? And I point this out only because it's funny, and also that it's, I don't know, 5,000 words long, 6,000 words long. Digging into the data behind John, James, and Jack in action movies. And what's hilarious is she passes over it at one point. She's like, well, maybe it's just that the names are common. Maybe, Demetria, maybe that John, my father's name, your name, is still understood to be a good, solid, serviceable name in Western culture that identifies as a person, like maybe John Wayne, for example, as the guy, right? And that's the kind of name that John is. So that was for our category of facile beyond belief, that gets the topic. The people at MSNBC, not the people, but a person at MSNBC offers this opinion piece from Ishan Alim, says Top Gun Maverick is the most insidious movie at the Oscars. And Zihan goes on at, again, needed an editor, goes on at great length to talk about how it's warmongering, glorifying all of the worst things ever, and how dare it be treated as legitimate when it is very terrible. So there you have it.
It's so true. I mean, let's face it, you know, let's face it. I don't know why you call it insidious. It's right there on the surface. Both Top Guns, the original and this one 35 years later, which is, I don't know, five times better a movie than the original. A very, very rare thing to say about a reboot or a long withheld sequel. Much better movie, much more emotionally resonant and not as foolish and all of that. But is it a paean to militarism and the military and the necessity of using big planes to take out enemies of the United States? It sure is, and it made $700 million in the United States because apparently, despite the views of MAGA on the one hand and the progressive left on the other, Americans like to see big American planes blowing up Iranian nuclear sites.
Hold on, John, okay. Just a second with your quote, obedience to the logic of empire. Quote, the subtext of bombing a nuclear enrichment site, which could very well be in Iran, is a striking choice that betrays a bellicose worldview. It revives the neoconservative conception of preventative warfare, the idea of using force to eliminate threats to American power before they can emerge. The enemy country presumably lacks nuclear bombs, but the U.S. is willing to intervene militarily in order to ensure it can't obtain them. It's a foreign policy paradigm that gives the U.S. license to ignore small things like, scare quotes, national sovereignty. It's also a particularly loaded scenario to portray at a time when, in the real world, the Iran nuclear deal is hanging by a thread and hawks are eager to scrap the diplomatic efforts and greenlight light bombardment of the country. I like that. Light bombardment.
This is ridiculous. The Iran nuclear deal is not hanging by a thread. It is dead. It has been dead for 6 years. Donald Trump pulled us out of the Iran nuclear deal. And guess what? Biden wanted to reinvigorate the Iran nuclear deal. And then, you know, Russia, which is the guarantor of the Iran nuclear deal, because it's supposed to hold the uranium and the plutonium that Iran develops, Russia then invaded a country called, it didn't preemptively invade, it didn't whatever. Russia invaded a country called Ukraine, and now we can't really use Russia as our intermediary. So also, yeah. You know, a movie in which we blow things up and then, you know, find our true love after a long period of time and help our friend's son make it. Yeah, that's America. And if you don't like it, go find another country. That's all I have to say.
I'm just sticking with light bombardment. Gwyneth Paltrow might be adding a light bombardment to her routine, and I like it. It has a Thurston Howell energy I like. All right, we got to pick up some speed here. Okay, it's after the jump. It's time for our obsessions of the week. A deep dive where we break down the stories we can't get out of our heads. John, guests go first. What is your obsession of the week?
So Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg is apparently preparing or very, very likely to indict Donald Trump on some complex charge that doesn't make a lot of sense when you read about it. I'm not even going to go into that. But if that is the charge that he is going to bring, the two key witnesses, I believe, who are going to be on the witness stand are Michael Cohen, who wanted to be Tom Hagen and is really Fredo, the fixer consigliere of Donald Trump.
I'm convicted.
A convicted felon who got himself out of prison because of COVID. He's one. And then the other is porn star sex worker Stormy Daniels, to whom the famous $130,000 payment was made, presumably to buy her silence about a sexual encounter with Donald Trump. Okay. So that's that story. Here's the thing. Nicole Wallace's show on MSNBC brought on Michael Cohen after he went and testified before the grand jury that convened by Alvin Bragg. And he says to Michael, he says to Nicole Wallace, if Stormy is someone they're going to look at as a substantial witness for this case, I am certain that she will do a fantastic job. So congratulations, Alvin Bragg. Michael Cohen thinks that your Stormy Daniels strategy is really a winner. And MSNBC's own Jordan Rubin followed this up with a piece also tweeted out by Nicole Wallace's show, Deadline White House, the headline of which is, and I am not kidding, why Michael Cohen wouldn't be as bad a prosecution witness as some may think. So he may not be a bad prosecution witness, even though he's a convicted felon. And he vouches for Stormy Daniels' brilliance as a witness. If these are the building blocks for this indictment of Donald Trump, God help America. Like, that is not good. And that's my obsession.
The bottom line, he says, is that prosecutors using challenging witnesses to make cases happens every day. And if Trump defense lawyers attack Cohen's credibility and morality, they risk turning the tables back on their client. Yeah, because otherwise Donald Trump definitely will not see his credibility and morality question. That's get ready. The Trump legal team is not prepared for Donald Trump's credibility and morality to be questioned here. Thank you for your obsession. My obsession is a leitmotif for me in this podcast, which is obsessive focus on climate, that the discussion of climate issues manifesting themselves into other spaces. The Los Angeles Times delivered a real Lulu headline: how white and affluent drivers are polluting the air breathed by LA's people of color. So you might say, don't white people breathe too? Aren't also white people frequent breathing enthusiasts? Isn't Gwyneth Paltrow breathing at her home? Well, Sammy Roth, the writer, says the areas where the interstates go through poor neighborhoods, which are predominantly not white, which are Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. And consequently, white devils who drive through these places to get to where they're going are leaving a disproportionate amount of pollution in these areas. And my obsession with this stuff is very often when we talk about race in America, we're just talking about poverty, right? It stinks to be poor. Being poor is hard. And if living in a bad neighborhood is hard, not having two parents, not all of the things are hard. And this isn't racism, right? This is that some neighborhoods are better than others. And the people who live in bad neighborhoods want to move to different neighborhoods that are not next to interstate abutments. And the people who live next to the interstate abutments do not say, oh, I would move, but I am Black. I would move, but I am Hispanic. No, they live in one of the most diverse cities in one of the most diverse states in the country. I doubt that Chris Rock is forced to live next to an interstate because he is Black. I would imagine he lives someplace very, very nice. I don't think race is what's going on here. And trying to have climate and environment, the focus, we talked about it in a recent, about a Washington Post story, about how racist it is that there are junk cars rotting off of Benning Road in Anacostia, and it's because of racism. It's because poor people don't have as nice a stuff and they don't have as much access to the goods of society as rich people. That's true of poor white people in West Virginia and Kentucky, and that's true of poor Black people in Los Angeles. That's true of poor people, and I hate this stuff because it is invidious, it is divisive, and it is designed not to address the alleged problems, but to shift guilt in inappropriate directions. And I say harumph unto you. Unto you all, I say harumph.
Okay? Well, harumph.
Thank you, sir. I didn't get a harumph out of that. Give the governor a harumph.
I gave you
exactly.
Harumph.
Exactly. The what was it? The Lepetamine Hospital, a mental hospital and gambling casino or casino for the mentally ill. Okay.
Yeah, right. This right. will be a landmark in the treatment of the mentally ill gambler.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. The funniest movie ever made. Okay, it's time for Eliana's favorite section, which is mailbag. It's the reader mail. Okay, our correspondent today is Mark Madeley, Madeley, from Houston, Texas. Hi, Chris and Eliana. John. I was watching the Thursday, March 9th congressional hearings that included two of the journalists who broke the story of broad government-imposed censorship of both left and right-wing speech and expression on Twitter, the bleep. Those guys go through from the Dems is unbelievable. The ranking member starts it off using the term so-called journalist. I'm interested in how different parts of the press are covering this and your takes on it. Have you ever been a witness in a hearing or witnessed a hearing? Waka waka. This is scary stuff just for regular citizens and much worse for journalists and professionals. Thank you, with kindness. Well, with kindness, I say to you, Mr. Madeley, I have been a witness in congressional testimony.
And recently.
It was about as much fun as getting a colonoscopy from a family of raccoons. But you do it, and you go, and so be it. John, I think this one is the treatment. So this is Barry Weiss, or Barry Weiss did not go.
And it was Matt Taibbi and I can't remember, Schellenberger.
Yes, Matthew Schellenberger. Yeah, right.
Matthew Schellenberger, right.
And so these are the...
Barry Weiss brought them on to help her excavate the Twitter censorship material that was given to her by Elon Musk.
So this is a we talked about it before, but just to lightly brush over it, this is journalists get exclusives all the time, right? It's a normal thing that media or that corporations or governmental entities look for the right journalist to give the story in hopes that they will get the right kind of coverage or to try to shape the story. It's very normal. In this case, Musk chose these folks, Barry Weiss and company, to give access to apparently selective parts. And last week we talked about the FTC trying to get the communications between the two, find out what really went on. But look, it's their journalists, and the sneering treatment of them by Democrats was nasty, but also, I don't know. I guess my takeaway from it was, like most congressional hearings, it didn't add up to a hill of beans and was mostly a platform for lawmakers to speechify. And what do you think?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Matt Taibbi is a journalist, and his work on this and excavating it was good, as was Schellenberger's, as was Barry's, as was all of this, even though Matt Taibbi wrote a piece recently on his Substack called John Podhoretz, You Suck. So I want to get credit for saying something nice. I'm not even going to go into why I suck.
Oh, okay,
but he said
fine.
I
well,
sucked.
Well, you don't.
Anyway, but I'm just saying this shows how emotionally capacious I am, that I can praise Matt Taibbi or at least give him credit for being a journalist, even
the light of pure reason
that I sucked. Yes. You never want to watch, if you believe in the American political system, never watch a congressional hearing.
Word.
They make you despair for our future, for our governing class, for what goes on in Washington. This has been true. I arrived in Washington. I don't live there anymore, but I arrived there in 1984, and I started, doing some coverage of Congress. I had friends who would be, at confirmation hearings. I would attend them and stuff, and watched, of course, all the hearings. And at best, they are horrible displays of preening, vanity, and grandstanding on the part of the congressmen who conduct them, or the staff, that the lawyers that they hire to conduct them. And if they are grilling somebody who is evil, if they are going after somebody who is really bad and that you really don't like, the dynamic the hearing inevitably makes you feel sympathetic for the poor abused person sitting behind the microphone who is getting yelled at by the school principal and the gym teacher. And it's terrible, and you should never watch them because they don't matter that much. They're not legislation. Often as we've seen in we had two impeachment hearings, and this, like, they don't work. They don't do what they're supposed to do. All they are is ritualistic sessions of abuse or self-praise. The Constitution doesn't call for hearings. It doesn't call. This is not part of our democratic process, and they suck. And I'm sorry that you had to watch one. That's all I can say.
That is good counsel. And the two things I would just say in conclusion on this. Number one, what's going on at the FTC is more concerning than the rudeness of members of the committee. Number one. Number two, take the cameras out of the committee rooms. Take the cameras out of the committee rooms. If we need to have a camera on the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate, fine. But the chances of any real fact-finding to go on when these people, politicians, are staring at the red light and know that they are on television and performing is about zero. So that's what I would say about that. Now it's time for my favorite time of the week, where we talk about our favorite items, where we talk about the things that delighted us. And I, as always, will lead by example to praise the Washington Post, the much maligned by me Washington Post. I will praise the Washington Post for a good editorial on Gavin Newsom's goofy-ah effort to say that the state will no longer do business with, is it Walgreens?
Walgreens, yeah.
Walgreens, because Walgreens is going to abide by the law in other states that say that they cannot sell abortifacients or morning after pills that are deemed to be in violation of new state abortion laws, and that Gavin Newsom is doing this that would make Ron DeSantis blush. And the important thing is to intellectual consistency in an editorial page is important, and it is the ballast on which you get to make your points later on. And the Washington Post delivered on this, talking about Gavin Newsom, who is a little bit of a silly person, and said that it's an abuse of government economic power. Yes, states have different cultural values and the leeway to structure their own public contracts, but that discretion should not extend to effectively ordering the companies with which they do business to disregard other states' laws. Reaching beyond their own borders that way undermines America's federal system. And I say booyah. Shout out to Michael Greva and the dangers of horizontal federalism. That's not how federalism is supposed to work. And good for the Washington Post for being consistent in its views.
Okay, so I guess my favorite story, I'm just going to read these details from the New York CBS station, Channel 2, its website, cbsnews.com/New York. Earlier this year, Mayor Ross Baraka of Newark, New Jersey, invited what he thought was the Hindu nation of Kailasa to Newark City Hall for a cultural trade agreement. But it turns out Kailasa is no nation at all. It's a fake, though it has a detailed website. Kailasa has no real government. It's the brainchild of Swami Nithyananda, a notorious scam artist and fugitive from India who has been on the run from rape charges since 2019. Now, Mayor Ross Baraka of Newark is the son of Amiri Baraka, born Leroy Jones, a playwright of the 1960s. Who later changed his name to Amiri Baraka, became a sort of revolutionary poet and man about Newark. And I'm now going once again to go personal, because it's very possible that Mayor Ross Baraka slept as a baby in the bassinet that I once occupied. Because
really,
my parents knew Leroy Jones in 1961 when I was born. And Leroy Jones's wife then had a baby. And my parent and I then outgrown the bassinet. And my parents gave the bassinet to Mr. and Mrs. Leroy Jones for their newborn baby. Mary Baraka is, I believe, 10 or 9 years younger than I, so I don't know whether he slept in the same bassinet that I did, but I just do think it's interesting that he might have been in the same spot as the child of a black separatist nationalist as the founding father and mother of neoconservatism's baby boy.
It's a full circle. My favorite quote from your favorite story is from City Councilman Luis Quintana. This is an oversight and cannot happen any longer. So that's good. So lessons learned going forward. We will no longer have fake countries as our cultural exchange partners.
I believe that the sister podcast of Inkstained Wretches is the nightly government podcast of the Duchy of St. Fenwick.
It's very true.
Which you may know as the country in The Mouse That Roared. Thus, dating myself. I'm so old.
They're sending us herring as part of the cultural trade. And John, you've got some herring coming from us. We really appreciate you and what you brought here and what you always bring. You are truly a friend of the podcast and a good journalist, a good man, and a favorite of mine. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's the news about the news. If you have a story you want us to talk about, email us at wretches@nebulouspodcast.com. That's wretches@nebulouspodcast.com. This has been Inkstained Wretches from Nebulous Media, produced by the hugely wealthy Colin Ciccola. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Wretches.